Yeah, there certainly are some gaps. Well, here we are, a month on the other side of the Feast of Tabernacles. One of the most important, I think, accomplishments of the feast is revealing our dedication. I think those that go will either show that they're sincerely dedicated and really have a desire to follow Yahweh, or maybe not so dedicated. These feasts are kind of like a spiritual gauge, I've noticed over the years. Those that have a real love of Yahweh just become back all gung-ho, and others that they're kind of on the line, just, well, it just shows their heart, I think. And it tends to separate those that are really true for those that are just going through the motions. At my work, we just had another review. We have annual reviews where the employee sits down and talks with the boss, see how everyone is doing, and to make sure that any problems that you have are corrected and you don't become habitual or ingrained. You know, Yahweh's feast days work the same, and Yahweh spreads them out throughout the entire year so that we can, you know, get our compasses back in line again with His Word, and we can fellowship with others and strengthen our walk. And it's necessary for our spiritual evaluation. Have I become lax? Is my zeal the same it was the day I dedicated myself to Yahweh? Have I deviated in any way from the truth? Unless Yahweh's laws are a central part of your life and you make a deliberate and conscious effort to obey and follow, there will be a type of kind of sponginess to your commitment, and there'll be gaps in your understanding. And the people in Laodicea found that out. Yahweh, in no uncertain terms, explained what they're all about, what it was doing to their spiritual life to be lukewarm. And believe it or not, Yahweh has blessings of understanding for those that go along when they understand the truth and then adhere to it. I'm always amazed to see the spiritual insights of those who, without any formal training, that don't have the LLDs or PhDs behind their name, have such a profound understanding of Yahweh's word. And I wonder, well, how did they come to this point? Well, I think one of the reasons is when they read it, they follow it, and Yahweh blesses them. The lesson of the parable of the talents says, be faithful over a few things, and I'll make you ruler over many things. And the more we prove our responsibility for Yahweh, and responsibility to be a true follower of Yahweh, the more He gives us. Let's look over in Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, verse 37. I want to read a number of verses here where Yahshua is speaking along this subject. Something I think we can glean. He says, blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, shall find watching. Verily I say unto you, that he shall gird himself and make them to sit down to meat, and will come forth and serve them. And if he shall come in the second watch, or come in the third watch, and find them, so blessed are those servants. Of course, he's speaking basically of himself, and how he's going to bless those who are committed. And this, know that if the good man of the house, who had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not have suffered his house to be broken through. But you therefore be ready also, for the Son of Man comes at an hour when you think not. Not expecting anything like this to happen. And here it is. Kind of like what happened, 9/11. Who would have ever thought something like that could have taken place? Then Peter said unto him, Master, speakest thou this parable unto us or to everyone? And he said, who then is that faithful and wise servant whom his master shall make ruler over his household to give them their portion of meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, shall find so doing. Of a truth I say unto you, that he will make him ruler over all that he has. He didn't make any distinction. He said, anyone who follows him will become a ruler. But, and if that servant say in his heart, my master delays his coming, and shall begin to beat the men servants and maidens, and to eat and drink, and to be drunken, the master of that servant will come in an hour when he looks not for him, at an hour when he is not there, and will cut him asunder, and will appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. And that servant which knew his master's will, and prepared not himself, neither did according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes. But he that knew not, and did commit things worthy of stripes shall be beaten with a few stripes. For unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall much be required. And to whom men have committed much, of him they will ask the more. Joshua details an important point here that each of us needs to be aware of, that when we're given something, we need to do something with it and to make profitable use of it, whether it's knowledge, whether it's a gift, whatever it might be, we have to use it. Use it or lose it, as the old saying goes. Speaking of parables, I was sent the following story that sort of illustrates today's epidemic of ignorance when it comes to the Bible, when it comes to the Scriptures. And because people don't know their Bibles and don't know what standards, it's the main reason why our culture is in a free fall, you know, a secular trip down to the abyss, where they've lost their moral compass. And when it comes to everything that constitutes, everything that Yahweh established is right and good, it seems, is under attack. Who would have thought just a few years ago that we'd be redefining what marriage is, of all things? I mean, how about redefining what children are? How about redefining what ownership means, or what gravity is, or what the color blue is? You know, silly, stupid. But of course, the only reason they're doing that is because they don't want the culture to look down on their sin. They want to be found acceptable. So redefine what a sodomite marriage would be, and then everybody will be happy. We've really lost it, and the forces of evil are all around us and gaining ground. And we'll be paying the ultimate price in this culture soon if we don't turn around. Well, part of that will come when people start to understand the Scriptures again. And it kind of is illustrated by this little story. This man who was trying out for the position as minister in a nominal church somewhere, and he was put before the ministerial council. A councilman asked him, "Sam, what part of the Bible do you like the best?" "Well, sir, I like the New Testament best," he says. "What book in the New Testament?" "What book, sir? What book? I think it's the book of parables." "Would you kindly relate one of those parables to this council?" Well, old poor Sam was really up against it at this point, but there was a possibility that the members of the council didn't know the Bible any better than he did, so he boldly went forward. He says, "Once upon a time, a man went down to Jerusalem, to Jericho, and fell among thieves, and the thorns grew up and choked that man, and he went on, and he didn't have any money, and he met the Queen of Sheba. And she gave that man, sir, 1,000 talents of gold and silver and 100 changes of raiment. And when he was driving along under a big tree, his hair got caught on a limb and left him hanging there. Yes, sir, he hung there many days and many nights, and the ravens brought him food and water to eat and drink. And one night while he was hanging there asleep, his wife Delilah came along and cut his hair off. And he dropped and fell on stony ground and began to rain, and it rained 40 days and 40 nights. And he hid himself in a cave, and the man went out into the highways and the byways and compelled them to come in. And he went on and came to Jerusalem and saw Queen Jezebel sitting high up in a window, and when she saw him, she laughed. And he said, 'Throw her down out of there.' And they threw her down. He said, 'Throw her down again.' And they threw her down 70 times 7, and the fragments they picked up were 12 baskets full. Now, whose wife will she be in the day of judgment?" Well, no one on the council felt qualified to question the candidate further, so he was hired. Well, I hope the man starts reading the book he proposes to teach, you know, but many people are about that confused when it comes to the Scriptures. All these things are garbled in their mind, you know, they've got all these stories and they don't know how they fit, how they apply, even if they should apply, you know, what part of the Bible we even accept. It's a popular and a confused way of life for many people out there. And that once we make a profession of our faith, our lives basically, for them, go on autopilot. And Yahweh just carries us on through no matter what we do. He just takes us completely over while we do nothing but go along for the ride. Anything else, like obeying the one we worship, is considered works righteousness, as they say, which to many is like the proverbial plague, you know. It doesn't take into account his power. And that's the common contention so popular today. Obedience is considered legalism. And for some reason, that's just horribly bad. I even this last week heard obedience compared to paganism. You can believe that, by a national evangelist on radio. I was driving home, and he was saying that, well, because the pagans were, you know, they had to obey certain things. If we start obeying like, you know, like they do, then we're in paganism. All we have to do is trust in his grace. Well, yeah, we do trust in his grace, but that's only because we fail to obey, and we keep striving to be obedient, to do as he has asked us to do, to follow in his ways. But it's all twisted up, like this poor man who has no concept of what it all, how it all works. Amazing. Real dedication and true commitment to Yahweh's way of life have been turned into evil concepts today. And the word tells us the standards of righteousness would indeed be turned upside down in our day. Let's turn to what the prophet said in Isaiah chapter 5 and look at verse 20. Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20. Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. Look at verse 24. Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flame consumes the chaff, so their root shall be as rottenness, and their blossom shall go up as dust. Because, notice, they have cast away the law of Yahweh of hosts and despise the word of the Holy One of Israel. And that is the punishment, and that is their lot. Woe unto them. There's an all-out effort by the forces of evil, as we know today, to do exactly that. Look at the abortion paradox. You know, if you murder a pregnant mother and her unborn child, you'll be charged with double murder, won't you? According to this Lacey thing that they just adopted. That's what the law says. But if you want to abort an unborn child yourself for convenience sake, because you just don't want to have a baby, infanticide is acceptable today. Yahweh has no room for double standards. And this, he even says in his word, and that specifically says that if you kill a woman who's pregnant and that baby dies, you will die. Or if the woman lives and the baby dies, you die. He's already said that. And this world has just now figured that out. Yahweh has no room for double standards. This degenerate world will soon learn that you don't toy with Yahweh's moral code. Paul in Romans chapter 7 tells us very plainly, and if you have friends that say, well, you know, you don't have to keep the Sabbath or the feasts, and, you know, that's all that old law, I hope that you remember this verse. Romans chapter 7, verse 1. And you can recite this to them. It says, know you not, brethren, for, now remember, this is New Testament, for I speak to them that know the law, how that the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives. That means that if you're a live man, you're under the law. If you're a live individual, a human being, you're under the law as long as you live. In verse 12, wherefore, the law is holy and the commandment holy and just and good. He boldly proclaimed that anything said otherwise is heresy. He said clearly that we are under the standards of Almighty Yahweh, whether we choose to accept them or not, redefine them or not, that's not going to make any difference because he is the judge. Just as he explains in verse 23, there is a natural pull in the human heart. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bring me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. It's a natural pull I have within me, and I've got to overcome that. To come up with such blasphemous statements that equate obedience of the word to paganism is about as low, I think, as it gets. You know, lower than a snake's belly, as they say. Forget the Old Testament for a while. Look at the hundreds of commands, the illustrations of obedience in the New Testament. As a matter of fact, if you get a Dake's reference Bible, annotated reference Bible, you'll find in the back he documents 1,050 New Testament commands and instructions that we're to obey. Documents every one of them. The standards are the same. Whether you're Abraham in Ur or John at Patmos, it doesn't matter. The standards are the same. Yahweh doesn't offer any instant formula that produces fully mature, complete righteous individuals. You know, no matter what they do or say, we don't become dedicated servants through passive thinking or passive non-activity. It doesn't just happen to us, like catching a virus, you know, or soaked up like osmosis. True spiritual growth comes through gutsy perseverance, applying what you hear by first believing it and then doing it and then growing in it and then following it. We touched on this in the Bible study last night. Do you have the faith to stand up to no matter what comes? Do you have the faith to stand up to someone who will kill you if you profess to follow Yahweh? Do you have that kind of faith? That's what it all boils down to. Unless you're willing to die for your beliefs, unless you're willing to go that far, then I don't think you really have the faith. And that's what that's really it's all about. We've come to that point in our walk that we are convicted that no matter what, we're going to stay strong to Yahweh, no matter what. And we're not going to bend, no matter what, no matter what comes. Yahweh's true people and his word have such a deep, abiding love and a conviction that they're ready to give up everything, even their own lives. And we see that over and over in the scriptures. The prophets, you know, and all the disciples, it seems, history says that they all, virtually all, died as martyrs. Many, many, many did. Read Fox's Book of Martyrs sometimes. And if you really want to test your own faith against the faith of even those in the early, quote, church, they'd put many today to shame what they went through. But you know, there's always the bright side. I'm always encouraged by Revelation chapter 2, verse 10, that says, "Fear none of those things which you shall suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison." So we're, you know, going to have to be tested in that way, thrown into prison, that you may be tried. Yahweh's going to allow that to see what's in our hearts. "And you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death." And here's the promise that I always get a lot of comfort from. "Be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life." That's a promise. If you're faithful unto death, if you're willing, and you do give up your life for your faith, you have a promise of an eternal crown. "He that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says unto the assemblies. He that overcomes shall not be hurt of the second death." If you overcome, you will not have to worry about the second death. Your name will be written in the book of life. That's a guarantee that comes with the ultimate sacrifice. You know, many today see the Muslims self-sacrifice for their false beliefs as something beyond the pale. How could people do that? You know, how could they be willing to give up their own lives so they can be, you know, somewhere up in heaven with so many virgins or whatever? And they're considered weird fanatics. Fanatics. I read just recently, Winston Churchill had a definition for fanaticism. He says, "A fanatic is someone who won't change his mind and refuses to change the subject." That was interesting, I thought. Very appropriate. But this world has lost the concept of adhering to something so strongly you're willing to give up everything for it. And you won't compromise. But Yahweh's people love Yahweh so much that they'll do whatever he commands. And if he commands us to obey his word, then that's what we must do. Whatever he says, we'll do it. The world considers that fanaticism. So why wouldn't it, you know? I mean, the culture hardly stands for any principles anymore, and the ones that are left, you know, the foundational ones are being destroyed too. So why wouldn't they consider that fanaticism? So what is the ultimate conclusion of doing what we think is right in our own eyes? Where is it all going to lead? Is the law so totally defunct that we now may, at our own pleasure, murder, lie, steal, whatever we want to do? A 19th century minister was calling on a shoemaker who had previously said he wasn't going to go to church because he didn't want to hear the Ten Commandments being spoken. He said the Ten Commandments were long ago abolished. Well, acting on a sudden thought, the preacher said, "Oh, well, I'm very glad that the Eighth Commandment is abolished, for I'm just now in want of a pair of boots, and I think these are my size." So, whereupon he picked up a pair and hurried out the shop and with the boots under his arm. Shoemaker chased him down and never again objected to the reading of the commandments. Well, as we've been teaching for many years, the truth of the scriptures is based in the covenant. The covenant that Yahweh gave to Israel. The covenant that you see in effect from Genesis, actually, starting with Abraham, all the way through to Revelation. You see the covenant. And that's the basis of what the whole Bible, I believe, is all about. The covenant promise is the promise of everlasting life for all people if they will prove faithful. And explaining who a true believer is, Paul in Romans chapter 9 says they're Israelites. Romans chapter 9, I want to look at four or five verses here, starting with verse 4. Romans 9 and 11 are parallel chapters that speak basically of the same thing, of being grafted in. He says in verse 4, who are Israelites? Who are these people? Are they people that are born in Israel? Or, you know, where are they? Who are they? He says they are Israelites to whom pertains the adoption and the glory and the covenants. Interesting. Here we are in the New Testament. And this apostle is telling us that they adhere to the covenants and the giving of the law that goes along with it and the service of Elohim and the promises. They do all these things, they have the promises as well. Who are the fathers and of whom, as concerning the flesh, Messiah came, who is over all, Elohim blessed forever? Not as though the word of Elohim has taken none effect, for they are not all Israel which are of Israel. In other words, others can be grafted in. Acts 10:35 speaks of that. Neither because they are the seed of Abraham are they all children. Don't have to be, you know, an offspring, a physical offspring of Abraham. But in Isaac shall your seed be called, it says. That is, they which are the children of the flesh, these are not the children of Elohim, but the children of the promise are counted for the seed. Those who take hold of that covenant promise are the ones who are considered the seed of Abraham and who will be blessed as he was, and the promise given to him, ultimately of everlasting life. For this is the word of promise. At this time will I come, and Sarah shall have a son. And then he goes on, explains the physical and how it relates as well. So here we have a promise that those who are grafted in can be those who are not of physical Israel. You see, the old covenant with its precepts of obedience forms the foundation even of New Testament truth. Not only that, but on which salvation itself is based. And this is the fact that's been lost. And that's why all these churches and all these people are swimming around out there in ignorance, trying to, well, they don't even try to understand it. They just throw most of it out and say, well, we're in an age of grace. So really, there's nothing in there that you really have to worry about other than belief. That's really all you need. They don't want to get into it and understand it because, who wants to come up against his own shortcomings? It's a fact that's been lost. The Old Testament has been diminished and denigrated by wrong-headed clerics for the past couple hundred years. This last week, I went to a used bookstore, and I picked up a book entitled, the title just fascinated me, The Origin and Permanent Value of the Old Testament. So I bought it. It was only $3. Thought I had a bargain. I think I did. The author has some great insights into why the Old Testament has been removed from churches all over the world and has been eclipsed by the last third of the Bible, known as the New Testament. What is really amazing, it was written in 1906. So if you can indulge the kind of, archaic way of communicating that they did back then. I want to read part of it. He begins the book by discussing Yahshua's love for the Old Testament and the old only scriptures available that he had in his day. He says, it requires no imagination to picture the young Jew of Nazareth eagerly studying in the synagogue, at the temple, and alone by himself, the sacred writings found in our Old Testament. For this fact is clearly recorded on every page of the Evangels. The events of Hebrew history and its heroes, Abraham, David, Eliah, were all familiar to him. The Old Testament was the background of a large portion of the Sermon on the Mount. From Deuteronomy 6, 4, and 5, and Leviticus 19, 18, he drew his marvelous epitome of all law and duty. In the wisdom literature, and especially in the book of Proverbs, he found many of those practical truths which he applied to life with new authority and power. From the same storehouse of crystallized experience, he derived certain of those figures which he expanded into his inimitable parables. He adopted also and put to use the effective gnomic form of teaching of the wisdom school, as in the mouth of his herald, John the Baptist, the great moral and spiritual truths first proclaimed by the ancient prophets live again in the lips of Yahshua. At every point in his teachings, one recognizes the thought and the language of the older scriptures. So how can people, I'm going to insert this, how can people say, you know, we go by the teachings of Yahshua and not recognize where those teachings came from? At the moment of his greatest temptation and distress, even in the last agony, the words of the ancient law and Psalms were on his lips, and their consoling and inspiring messages in his mind. What is so strikingly true of Yahshua is equally true of the apostles and the disciples who have given us the New Testament books. The atmosphere in which they lived, the thoughts which they thought, and the language in which they spoke were those of the Old Testament. For them and for the early assembly, until at least the middle of the second Christian century, the only scriptures recorded as authoritative were those of the Old Testament. Even then, only gradually and under pressure of real needs were different groups of Christian writings added and ascribed an authority equal to that of the older scriptures. Throughout the Middle Ages, and in the eyes of the Protestant reformers, the two great divisions of the Bible continued to command equal respect and attention. From the Old Testament and its reflection of the teachings of Paul, Puritanism and the theology of the past three centuries derived most of that which revealed their strength as well as their weakness. I thought it was interesting, too, because then he goes and I haven't read this book by any means, but I've read the first section of it. And he goes and he lists three reasons why the Old Testament has been virtually removed from view today. He said one of them was, and something I guess we've lost, but you'd only know that back maybe 100 years ago, is a reaction against stern Puritanism. And he means the teachings of the Puritans who base their strict spirit of justice and uncompromising stand against sin on the Old Testament. And people couldn't handle that. Of course, that's hardly a dynamic today, but it could have been a contributing reason for the initial distaste for the Old Testament maybe 100 years ago, you know. Then another reason, he says, is the higher criticism. And that was the supposed scientific analysis of everything, you know, back in the 19th century. Well, they started to question everything and question the time-honored belief even of the Bible as the direct inspiration of Yahweh. This higher criticism sprang out of the rationalism, the German rationalism of the 19th century, where science and human reason were used to explain everything about our world. Evolution sprang from this movement, really. There was a whole era of this sort of thing going on. And it said that the Bible is the product of an editorial cut-and-paste job. It looked at some of the manuscripts and say, well, this is one source of manuscripts, we'll call that the J source, and here's another one, we'll call that the E source because it has Elohim in it, and then they just kind of, from different people, who knows if they were inspired or not, doesn't matter, they just stuck it all together, and that they tried to explain away some of the variances of the text, this whole idea is being poo-pooed today by scholars and say it's not true, and yet there's a man down south who, and we keep getting these questions, says that the word Elohim is pagan because of, and he refers to the E and the J text. He said you can't find Elohim in the J text, therefore it was added by some other, you know, editor, and therefore it's, you know, because it was used in among some pagan people, it's a pagan word. That's how he explains it all. And so I went to the Anchor Bible Dictionary one time, and I looked it up, and there it said plainly, Elohim's use in the J text, and, you know, blew his whole thing right out of the water. He hadn't done his homework. And then he says the third reason the Old Testament has been eclipsed is that it is couched in Hebrew culture, and our Western world is more studied in and comfortable with Greco-Roman. And I can sure believe that. I mean, you look at Christianity today, it's just infused with Greco-Roman thought, iconology, and everything else. And they wanted to get as far away as they could, simply because, for one thing, they didn't understand the Hebrew culture. And so that they had a tendency to, well, you know, that's something that, you know, the Old Testament is really not modern enough for us, and we don't understand it anyway. And so, you know, and it's true, nearly all New Testament versions are based on a Greek manuscript. And Paul wrote to many assemblies in Greece and Macedonia, but still, he was writing to those believers who understood the truth of Almighty Yahweh. And they were Hebraic in their understanding. Yahshua and the disciples were Jews. They wrote from a Hebrew point of view, using Hebrew expressions, idioms, analogies, cultural parallels, all of that, based in the Hebrew. Another reason he alludes to, and certainly can verify this, is because the Old Testament projects a Hebraic way of thinking. He says one of the reasons that they rejected it was because of anti-Semitic feelings. They didn't like anything that smacked of Judaism. And we know that's true. History tells us that Constantine, one of the reasons he did what he did, changing the things like the Sabbath to Sunday and the feast days and bringing in all these pagan days, is because of a desire to get away from Judaism, and because they held an anti-Semitic view. Interesting, I just read in the paper yesterday, this Bin Laden, you know, he's come out with this video, and they don't give you much in there, I think, just a few minutes of what he said. But I didn't see anything in there of him saying, I want to take away your freedoms. What he did say in there is that he didn't like Israel's treatment of the Palestinians and the America's support of Israel. And that's what it's all about. More anti-Semitism coming out. That's what it's all about. They won't tell you that in the news because they want to get you all, you know, fired up under a patriotic fervor and all of that. But it's a religious war. Let's face it, it's a religious war. People used to understand that the Bible is one complete uniform book from Genesis through Revelation. No exclusions, no eliminations. Everything was taken as it stood. But what's happening today with all of the new biased Bible versions coming out to fit particular doctrines is that the Bible, like history, is being rewritten. 100 years from now, people are going to pick up a version of the Bible and say, hey, this must be true, and not realize these things were added, they're changed. They're messing with the text. And they're going to do more and more of it. If you don't like the standards, get rid of the standards. You know, don't change your life. Like the old man, you know, who read so much about the bad effects of smoking that he gave up reading. No longer is obedience being taught today. No longer are we told that sin has consequences. For Pete's sake, sin isn't even being talked about anymore. We just waft on through, you know, going to the kingdom, doing whatever we like. We're on autopilot and we zoom right up into, you know, into glory. It's the easiest religious teaching on earth. And it requires nothing of us but some kind of belief. It's like they're not even looking at 99% of the rest of the Bible. And I'm talking both Old and New Testaments. 1 Peter chapter 1. How can anyone with half a mind read what Peter wrote here and take it for anything other than what it clearly states? 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope to the end, for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Yahshua the Messiah, as obedient children, not fashioning yourselves according to the former lusts in your ignorance, but as he which has called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation. That word conversation really means behavior. In all manner of behavior, be set apart. Be different. Follow a different standard. Because it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy. If you call on the Father, who without respect of persons judges according to every man's work, pass the time of your sojourning here in what? Fear. Fear. Be careful. Be careful and be very cautious. It's not just put me on autopilot. There's nothing for me to do. 1 Peter 2:9. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people. Now, why are his people called peculiar? Why would he use that term? Because they're different, you see. They don't fit in. They're different. They follow a different standard, a different goal. That you should show forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Praises is the Greek arete and means moral goodness and virtue. It's talking about behavior. It's not talking about singing songs. Show forth the righteous behavior of him who has called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. You ask yourself, well, how can anyone pervert the scriptures more than in saying that how we behave means nothing? Well, let's look at 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 1. Peter has a lot to say about this subject. It's one of the better books on it. But there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privately shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the master that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. They're going to deny the existence of Yahshua. Well, if they throw out the New Testament, as some are throwing out the Old Testament, they're going to do that. They're going to deny the existence of Yahshua. They're going to deny Yahshua. Notice verse 2. And many shall follow their pernicious, their harmful ways. Bullinger says the text reads lascivious ways, very lawless ways, by reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of. Are we not seeing that today in the news? Every newspaper you pick up, somewhere in there, the way of truth is being tread upon. People are denigrating it, trying to get rid of Yahweh's word and make it go away. Pernicious ways. And through covetousness, they shall, with feigned words, fabricated, making up their own stories, make merchandise of you. What are they after? What are they after? They're after mammon, filthy lucre. So they make up their own teachings. You hear them all the time, taking a phrase out of the Bible, not even a whole sentence, but just a phrase, what they call their text, and then design a whole message around nothing but their own ideas. Because they're tickling ears so they can get filthy lucre. They know they start preaching Yahweh's word, it ain't going to fly. It's not going to go beyond the walls. And they won't have anybody left to talk to because people don't want to hear the strong word anymore. And whose judgment now of a long time lingers not, and their damnation slumbers not. There is going to be a day of reckoning, is what he's saying. There is going to be a day of reckoning. Verse 9. Yahweh knows how to deliver the righteous out of temptations and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. Then over in verse 19. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are the servants of corruption. Interesting terminology there, isn't it? You're free of the law. You have nothing to worry about. They themselves are servants of what? Corruption. For of whom a man is overcome, of the same he is brought into bondage. Nothing to do but believe. The key to the truth, brethren, is found in the covenant from the former to the latter. Jeremiah 31 talks about it, talks about the day will come when this covenant will be in force. Jeremiah 31:31. Behold, the days come, says Yahweh, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they broke. They broke my covenant. I didn't break it. It wasn't my fault. The terms were broken. Although I was an husband unto them, says Yahweh, but this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. Oh, we're going to have a new covenant. People say we're in a new covenant today, so it must be just believe. I don't read that. I'm looking for just believe somewhere in that. I don't see it. What I do see there is after those days, says Yahweh, I will put my law in their inward parts and write them in their hearts and will be their Elohim, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know Yahweh. For they shall all know me, from the least unto the greatest of them, says Yahweh, for I will forgive their iniquity and I will remember their sin no more. Is that true? Not every man today knows Yahweh, do they? He says there's coming a time when they will. This new covenant that's promised here has not reached ultimate fulfillment yet, but we're in the opening throes of it. And those that will adhere to it will understand what the truth is all about. And they will be blessed for it. But one day this whole world will be united under that new covenant that we are just now beginning to understand and live. Hebrews chapter 8 is a parallel, basically quoting Jeremiah 31:29-34. Same thing. So if you don't believe that it's applicable in the New Testament, just go to Hebrews chapter 8 and see the same thing. Obviously, that clinches it, doesn't it? Read about and promised in the old, again, promised and read about in the new. He says, I will make with the house of Israel after those days, I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, verse 10. And I'll be to them an Elohim, they shall be to me a people. He's going to write his laws in our hearts. What does that mean? Kind of bury them so we don't have to think about them anymore because we're on autopilot? Let's turn to Ezekiel chapter 11, verse 19. And I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within you, and I will take the stony heart of their flesh and will give them a heart of flesh. He'll take the stony heart out of their flesh, and I'll give them a heart of flesh. How does he do that? What happens when that happens? Verse 20, that they may walk in my statutes and keep my ordinances and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their Elohim. That's what it means to put something in your heart. The key, Yahweh's standards of righteousness, to obey his laws, to do what he says. It only makes sense. If he is bringing us into his family, he's going to teach us to be a good family member. You don't like to have a renegade, a maverick in your family, do you? You know, one of the children just does not behave. You're constantly after him. Change your ways, you know. You're constantly after him because you know that he's self-destructing. You want him to be an honorable member, loving member, obedient member of your family as a parent. Same thing Yahweh wants. It all makes perfect sense. And yet we hear just the opposite, don't we? Apply those laws, not just in rigid do's or don'ts, but apply them in all ways as Yahshua taught us. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 2. There's this covenant that we this new covenant that's going to be enforced will be enforced with true and righteous understanding. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 11. Wherefore remember that you being in time past Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by that which is called circumcision in the flesh, made by hands, that at that time you were without Messiah, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without Elohim in the world. Here's the way you were. You were outside the promise, the covenant promise. But verse 13 gives us hope. But now in Messiah, you who were sometimes afar off are made nigh by the blood of Messiah. We're saved. Saved by that blood that was shed. For he is our peace, who has made both one and has broken down that middle wall of partition that was between us, that thing that separated. The promise was given to Israel. Everyone outside that promise had no hope. Yahshua broke that down when that veil came down in the temple. And some believe it was attached like to big stones. And when those stones fell, it just ripped it right in two. We have access to Yahweh. Everyone has access through Yahshua the Messiah. So that everyone now is not separated. We're all become one. Broken down that middle wall of partition between us, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments and ordinances, man-made things that separate. And that's what they did. Yahweh's laws aren't enmity, but man has written his own to separate, so that they could continue on being the promised people and everybody else shut out. That's basically what he's talking about. Yahshua took care of that as well. Verse 16, that he might reconcile both unto Elohim in one body by the stake, having slain the enmity thereby. Notice that. There's no enmity in Yahweh's ways, but there is enmity in man's ways. And came and preached peace to you which were afar off and to them that were nigh. For through him we both now have access by one Spirit unto the Father. Now therefore you are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of Elohim, and are built upon the foundation of, notice this, we're tying again with the old and the new, the apostles and the prophets. Yahshua himself being the chief cornerstone. You see the tie-in? It's all one book, brethren. The apostles and the prophets. Everyone has the promise. In whom all the building, fitly framed together, grows into a holy temple in the Master. In whom you also are built together for a habitation of Elohim through the Spirit. You're built together like a temple, all put together, all the stones together. Well, when you understand what the covenant promise is all about, it all starts to make sense. All the pieces start to fit into a picture now that you can finally get some sense out of. The Bible starts to make sense when you see there is a theme running throughout all. It can all tie into that theme. Otherwise, you're like that poor guy who's got all his stories mixed up. You can't seem to get through it. You can't seem to make any sense of it. And millions are out there trying to make sense of it, and they're only seeing bits and pieces here and there. They don't see the theme. Isaiah chapter 24. Isaiah 24 tells us that there's judgment for a specific reason. And I want to close with this. 24 and verse 5, the earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof because they have what? Transgressed the laws. Changed the ordinance. Basically abolished it. Broken the what? The temporary covenant. The Old Testament covenant. No, it says the everlasting covenant. Therefore has the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left, because they have broken the everlasting covenant. If you don't understand what it is, you're going to break it. It's time everyone understood what that everlasting covenant is all about, how we can be grafted into the promise given to Israel, that we can all, as Yahweh's people, receive the blessings, ultimately the crown of rulership in a coming kingdom that's going to encompass this whole world. May Yahweh bless you.